You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Denk an den 31. Juli.
Wieso?
Last Call für deine Steuer.
Oh no, ich weiß gar nicht, wo ich anfangen soll.
Weil wieso Steuer? Das ist wie Steuererklärung, nur ohne Stress.
Ist das einfach?
Klar, macht fast alles automatisch.
Dauert das lange?
Nö, einfach per App.
Na dann.
Hol dir jetzt dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer. Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 116, Strike Hard. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. I don't like to brag, but there's never been a popular history of the Napoleonic era on this scale before. It's only possible for me to do this because so many of you have chosen to chip in financially. If you'd like to help, visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon. Patrons also get access to ad-free versions of the regular episodes and special monthly bonus episodes. That's patreon.com/ageofnapoleon. Anyway, we left off last time at the beginning of fall 1808. The desperate, chaotic summer had seen a number of successes by the Spanish and Portuguese, backed up by their British allies. The failures of the French and the strength of the Iberian patriots had shocked the whole world. Only a few months earlier, it seemed all of Europe was at Napoleon's feet. Now, the strategic picture was very uncertain. Spain was now almost entirely in the hands of the juntas. Most of the remaining French troops in the country had retreated to the far bank of the Ebro River, which is not far from the Pyrenees, leaving only a relatively small strip of the country still under occupation. In Portugal, the remains of General Jean-Andoche Junot's force were in Allied custody, awaiting transportation back to France, per the terms of their ceasefire agreement with the British, the so-called Convention of Cintra, signed by Junot and British General Sir Hugh Dalrymple. For over a decade, the British had been seeking a secure base of operations on the European continent to carry out ground warfare against the French and to collaborate with their continental allies. They had tried in western France, in the Netherlands twice, in southern Italy, and in northern Germany. Every one of these efforts had failed, some at great cost. At long last, they had achieved this aim in Iberia. Tens of thousands of redcoats were already ashore, with more already on the way. They had access to good ports at Lisbon, Porto, and at La Coruña, in northwestern Spain, to maintain their lines of communication and supply back to Britain. The local people and the authorities in these areas were friendly and more or less cooperative. The nearest French troops, who were not prisoners, were hundreds of miles away. With the failure of Junot's attack at Vimeru, the French had lost their only chance at destroying this foothold before the British could get established. I think it's fair to say this victory in Portugal was one of the greatest British successes of the war so far. The so-called sepoy general who had commanded these victories, Sir Arthur Wellesley, had performed well, as had his officers and soldiers. Back home in Britain, news of this success was greeted with anger. Lord Castlereagh, Secretary of State for War and the Colonies, wrote to General Dalrymple, quote, "To express the surprise felt by His Majesty, that a convention of so important a nature as that which formed the basis of the definitive arrangement should have been agreed to." End quote. He went on to explain that Dalrymple had been recalled to England. Expressing the surprise felt by His Majesty may sound pretty mild, but in the world of the early 19th century British elite, this would have been understood as a severe reprimand. The poet William Wordsworth remembered how news of the convention hit the public. Quote, "Wherever the tidings were communicated, they carried agitation along with them. Not a street, not a public room, not a fireside in the island, which was not disturbed as by a local or private trouble. Men of all estates, conditions, and tempers were affected apparently in equal degrees." End quote. Lord Byron devoted a few lines of his poem Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, which we quoted from last episode, to denouncing the convention. Quote, "Convention is the dwarfish demon styled that foiled the knights in Marialva's dome. Of brains, if brains they had, he them beguiled, and turned a nation's shallow joy to gloom. Here folly dashed to earth the victor's plume, and policy regained what arms had lost. For chiefs like ours, in vain may laurels bloom. Woe to the conquering, not the conquered host, since baffled triumph droops on Lusitania's coast. And ever since that martial synod met, Britannia sickens, Sintra, at thy name, and folks in office at the mention fret, and fain would blush, if blush they could, for shame. How will posterity the deed proclaim? Will not our own and fellow nations sneer to view these champions cheated of their fame, by foes in fight or throne, yet victors here, where scorn her finger points through many a coming year?" End quote. As the controversy mounted, Generals Wellesley and Dalrymple, along with a third senior commander, General Sir Harry Burrard, were recalled to London to face a parliamentary inquiry. All three men were officially cleared of any wrongdoing, but only Wellesley really came off well. He had opposed the convention, but had lacked the authority to do anything about it. Both Burrard and Dalrymple were pilloried in the British press. Their reputations never recovered. Neither man would ever command troops in the field again. Perhaps the politicians should have known better. In this era, it was quite common for this type of surrender agreement to allow the defeated side to return home. We've seen this many times in past episodes. Garrisons of cities or fortresses defeated in a siege, marching home with their muskets on their shoulders and flags packed safely away. You might remember that after the final failure of the French expedition to Egypt, the remnants of the Army of the Orient got exactly the same treatment, transported across the Mediterranean, courtesy of the Royal Navy. But the British public was inflamed. Perhaps the press had been too enthusiastic in trumpeting Wellesley's victories at Rolissa and Vimeru, leading to unrealistic expectations of a total victory, which were then disappointed by news of the convention. You might quibble about some of the details, and there certainly had been some mistakes in how they had gone about it, but Dalrymple was probably right to seek a negotiated settlement with Junot. British interests were best served by getting the French out of Portugal as soon as possible. Laying siege to the remains of Junot's army in Lisbon would have taken valuable time and caused unnecessary complications, along with more destruction and more casualties, both civilian and military. In any case, I think the controversy around the convention illustrates just how eager the British public were to prosecute the war against France. As you might recall from past episodes, Napoleon had long hoped that anti-war sentiment would take hold of the British public, as it had before the Treaty of Amiens, and lead to pro-peace factions gaining ascendancy in the British Parliament, so he could negotiate another treaty and get Britain out of the war. As the British press and much of the public bayed for General Junot's blood, that hope was looking increasingly forlorn. Meanwhile, with Wellesley, Burrard, and Dalrymple back in England, command of British troops in Iberia passed to 47-year-old General Sir John Moore, generally seen as one of the most capable and charismatic officers in the British Army, although he had his detractors as well, as we'll discuss in the future. Moore began moving his troops into Spain. As of yet, the Allies did not know what Napoleon was planning, but it was clear to everyone that the fighting in Spain was not over. Moore wanted to be there when the action restarted. However, he learned the same things Junot and his troops had discovered almost exactly a year earlier. Central Iberia is very rough country, particularly in heavy autumn rain. Unfortunately for the coalition, Moore's army would be nowhere near the front by the time Napoleon made his move. That was bad news for the Spanish, because when that day came, they would be facing a fearful onslaught. In the space of only about 3 weeks, roughly 100,000 French troops were transferred from Germany to Spain and southern France. Some of these were fresh recruits, but by and large, these were veteran units. Most had at least one campaign under their belt. Among the best French line units, there were still tens of thousands of men who had trained at the Camp of Boulogne and fought in the great victories of 1805 and 6. Getting so many men halfway across the continent, along with all their supplies and equipment, in only 3 weeks was a real achievement. A young French lieutenant would later recall, quote, "We journeyed by brigades. Columns of 400 or 500 four-horse wagons traveled at the trot, each carrying 2 regiments. Twice a day we ate meals which we found prepared for us in the fields bordering the road. By this means, we covered 30 leagues a day, spending each night in villages or bivouacs." End quote. 30 leagues a day is about 90 miles, or 144 kilometers, which is an absolutely breakneck pace by the standards at the time. As the troops passed through France, the local residents turned out to cheer for them. Many towns and villages built makeshift triumphal arches, temporary miniature versions of the one that was being built in Paris. These celebrations were not spontaneous. Napoleon sent orders down that chain of local government we discussed in episode 107, indicating that he wanted his soldiers to feel the whole country was behind them as they made their way to this new campaign. Still, authentic or not, these displays apparently did help with morale. By mid-autumn, there were roughly 200,000 French soldiers in the region of the Pyrenees, eagerly anticipating the emperor's order. Awaiting them across the Ebro River were about 125,000 Spanish troops. With Moore's army nowhere close, the French would have a considerable numerical advantage in the coming campaign. On top of that, there was a huge gulf in quality. As we've discussed in past episodes, the bulk of the Spanish forces were freshly raised regiments of patriotic volunteers. They lacked basically everything that made Napoleonic soldiers effective: training, equipment, experience, supplies, organization, and leadership. There were exceptions to this characterization, but by and large, this was still a ragtag, improvised rebel army. Things were not going well behind the Spanish lines, either. With the French nearly expelled from the country, the Patriots could breathe a little easier. Unfortunately, as is often the case in politics, without the immediate threat of a common enemy, divisions within the Patriot camp became more stark. On September 25th, representatives of all the provincial juntas in Spain gathered in Madrid to convene a new institution, the Supreme and Central Governing Junta of Spain and the Indies, usually referred to as the Supreme Junta or the Central Junta. As that name suggests, this would be a provisional central government of the whole country, a committee of 35 delegates, drawn from prominent members of the provincial juntas, and chaired by the Count of Floridablanca, perhaps the country's most eminent statesman. He had been prime minister under the reforming King Charles III, and was seen as the leader of the liberal faction at court. The delegates of the Supreme Junta had their work cut out for them. The country was in a state of disunity and disorganization. Its armies were outnumbered and about to face an offensive by vastly superior forces, led by the greatest commander of the age. Unfortunately for Spain, the politicians found they could agree on almost nothing. Each delegate had been sent to Madrid to represent the interests of his home province, and those interests did not always align. When the delegates disagreed, there was no set procedure to come to a consensus. Remember, there was no written Spanish constitution to work from. None of these institutions was more than a few months old, so there was no historical precedent to work from either. The delegates themselves must have been well aware that they needed to get to work on a whole host of urgent questions. But they found they spent most of their time just trying to keep the Supreme Junta functioning. At this stage, there was still no unified national command structure coordinating the various Patriot armies. Each army was under the authority of the province that raised it. Effectively, there was no Spanish military, just a coalition of provincial armies, all fighting in the same cause, but without any overarching institution coordinating their actions. Obviously, this would not do. The Supreme Junta debated the issue almost endlessly. They briefly settled on a candidate for Supreme Commander, General Gregorio Garcia de la Cuesta. But his political enemies moved against him almost immediately. He was soon dismissed, and the politicians were unable to reach a consensus on his replacement. And so, the Spanish armies would face Napoleon's onslaught without anyone in overall command. Similar events played out on the local level. Rival juntas tried to sabotage or even arrest one another. Within the Patriot armies, officers were promoted, appointed, or fired based on the political machinations within the provincial junta back home. We've talked in past episodes about what a miracle it was that this provisional government managed to spring up almost spontaneously, practically from nothing. Unfortunately for Spain, that miracle had only been possible under very specific conditions. Without the indignity and fear stirred up by the occupying French forces, and without Manuel Godoy lurking in the background, uniting the country in disgust, no amount of resolve could paper over the political divisions within Spain. Despite the disunity among the Patriots, the Spanish planned to attack. At first glance, that might sound completely insane, but they did have their reasons. The French were in retreat. The Spanish had the initiative. There are really only two viable routes for enemy armies to enter Iberia. The coastal plains of Catalonia on the Mediterranean side and in the Basque Country on the Atlantic side. Neither was very far from the current front line along the Ebro. If the Spanish could secure one or both of these locations, their position would be much more secure. And there were more than the obvious strategic considerations. There's always an imperative to attack when part of the country is under occupation. This has been true in all kinds of wars throughout history, right up until the present day. There's a natural impulse to expel the invader and reclaim the lost territory. This is not a purely philosophical matter. Governments have to worry about public opinion, and can't afford to be seen as sitting idle while part of the country is despoiled by foreign invaders. And given all the surprising successes of the past few months, perhaps we can't blame the Spanish for pushing their luck. Not so long ago, the idea that the Patriots might win victories like the ones at Bailén or Saragossa would have sounded far-fetched. By now, the French had already been expelled from about 90% of Spanish territory. Was it really so crazy to believe that, with one last effort, that final 10% might fall too? And so, the Spanish forces began concentrating along the coastal plains for a dual offensive aimed at forcing the French off the peninsula. 80,000 men would participate in this offensive. Roughly 20,000 were needed at Barcelona, where the French garrison was under siege. That left fewer than 25,000 men to maintain the whole rest of the front line. The Spanish were putting almost everything they had into this offensive. It was a big risk, but if it worked, Spain might be free of the French for the foreseeable future. Not everyone was optimistic. When the commander of British forces in Iberia, Sir John Moore, was shown the plan, he said, quote, "This is a sort of gibberish which men in office use and fancy themselves military men, but without knowing how far it is susceptible of being carried into practice." End quote. As the Patriots began preparing for the big push, the French quickly became aware something was afoot. With so much Patriot activity along the two coastal plains, by far the most strategic locations in this part of the world, you didn't need to be a genius to be able to guess what the Spanish were planning. Even before he arrived at the front, Napoleon was already formulating a plan of his own. He would aim to turn the tables on the Spanish, allow them to advance along the coastal plains, then crush their spearheads once they were exposed. Then he would punch right through the weakened center with the main body of his force and rush for Madrid, which was not only the capital, but the country's main transportation hub. Bonaparte was confident he could get this whole Spanish fiasco wrapped up quickly. He wrote to his younger brother Louis, the King of Holland, quote, "I need great force in Spain. I want to strike hard, and I hope to have a general peace before January." End quote. He was planning on arriving in Spain in early November, so apparently he believed this could all be wrapped up in less than 2 months. Very optimistic, even taking into account the disparity between the two armies. Napoleon arrived at the front on November 5, 1808. Marcellin Marbeau, a French officer we've quoted from many times in the past, recalled the effect it had on the second-line troops, who had performed so poorly in the early phase of the war in Spain. Quote, "Rest and camp life had given these young recruits a military air, which they had been far from having the previous July. But what most raised their tone was finding themselves under the command of the Emperor in person, and hearing that the veterans of the Grande Armée had arrived." End quote. Throughout the rest of the Napoleonic Wars, many people would comment on this phenomenon. When Napoleon took command of inexperienced or otherwise substandard troops, they seemed transformed simply by his presence. The Duke of Wellington would famously say Napoleon's presence on the battlefield was worth 40,000 men. Obviously, there was nothing mystical going on here. The troops felt more confident because of Napoleon's reputation. By now, everyone in Europe knew he had never lost a major battle, and that he took good care of his men. Young Frenchmen had been raised to look at Napoleon as a man of destiny, a world historical figure, whose legacy would stand for centuries. Many were proud to call themselves one of his soldiers. Bonaparte gave strict orders to his subordinates. No one was to make any aggressive move without direct orders from the imperial headquarters. He wanted to lure in the Spanish offensive. Any significant resistance from the French could put the patriots on their guard, or even lead them to abandon the offensive altogether. In fact, it was already a little late for this. On October 25th, the French had launched a small counterattack near the city of Logroño. They succeeded in pushing the Spanish back. Patriot commanders became more cautious, and the advance slowed to a crawl. In the north of Spain, near the Atlantic, Marshal François Lefebvre was preparing to compound this error by launching another attack. He knew the Emperor's orders, but his scouts had detected a large Spanish column in a very vulnerable position. Apparently, Lefebvre couldn't resist this perfect opportunity. Napoleon had made his wishes quite clear, but the goal of the Emperor's plan was the destruction of the Spanish armies. If Lefebvre achieved that, all would be forgiven. Lefebvre's IV Corps would face off against the Army of Galicia, led by General Joaquin Blake, yet another Spanish general of Irish origins, and one of the better Patriot commanders. Both sides had roughly 20,000 men, but the Spanish were not deployed for a battle, and the French had the element of surprise. Lefebvre hoped to exploit these advantages to trap Blake and force him to surrender. The French succeeded in surprising the Spanish and inflicted some severe casualties. However, the Patriots managed to hold together, fought their way out of the trap, and retreated from the battlefield in good order. This battle goes by many names. Zornosa seems to be the most common, but I've also seen it referred to as the Battle of Pancorbo and the Battle of Durango. Whatever you want to call it, it was a French victory. Lefebvre's corps lost only a few hundred men, compared to perhaps as many as 1,000 casualties among the Army of Galicia. But despite this result, no one was celebrating at French headquarters. Napoleon had given strict orders that no offensive action was to be taken without his direct orders. Lefebvre had taken a big risk in disobeying him, and it had not paid off. The Patriot forces in the north had been alerted to the danger. They were now in full retreat, just when Napoleon wanted them moving forward, exposing themselves even further. The emperor would have to change his plans on the fly. Of course, this was far from the first time. In fact, as we've seen again and again from our very earliest episodes, improvisation was one of Napoleon's greatest skills. He would shift his focus almost exclusively to the north, try to force a major battle in this part of the front as soon as possible, before the Patriots could slip away. The pursuit would be carried out by Lefebvre's 4th Corps and 1st Corps under Marshal Claude Victor. It was not well managed. The French advanced haphazardly, allowing their units to become separated. Many historians have commented that they seemed to have underestimated their Spanish enemies. After all, Blake had been defeated quite easily at Zornosa. Despite their defeat, his army had actually performed relatively well, but this fact seems to have been forgotten in the eagerness to catch the retreating Patriots. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to the French, Blake had received significant reinforcements. Several thousand trained regulars from the old Royal Army, led by a capable general, the Marquis of La Romana. These were the troops who had been rescued by the Royal Navy in that daring operation along the Danish coast, which we covered last episode. With his pursuers disorganized and strung out on the march, and his own forces strengthened, Blake decided to fight. He halted the retreat at a town called Valmaseda and began to prepare an ambush. The vanguard of Marshal Victor's 1st Corps walked right into it. The Patriots were able to surround an entire division of 13,000 men under General Eugène Casimir Villat. Blake sent a messenger into the French lines, inviting Villat to surrender. He refused. The vanguard division would fight for its life. It could have been a disaster for the French, almost on the scale of Bailen. However, the French troops held their nerve, and Villat and his officers responded just as they should have, forming a huge square to keep the Spanish at bay, then waiting for the right moment to punch through the encirclement and rush back the way they came. The division was saved, although they had to leave behind almost their entire baggage train. 300 of Villat's troops were killed or wounded, and another 300 captured. Blake lost only a few dozen men and captured much-needed supplies and equipment. Only a few months ago, Napoleon's armies had seemed invincible. Now, French defeats were becoming a matter of routine. The emperor was unhappy, to put it mildly. He ordered his loyal chief of staff, Marshal Berthier, to issue a rare official reprimand to Marshal Victor. Quote, "His Majesty is severely displeased that you left General Villat at grips with the enemy without moving to his aid." End quote. Just like with Marshal Bernadotte 2 years earlier, when Napoleon was really angry at one of his commanders, he was usually smart enough to let Berthier do his talking for him. Berthier was a consummate professional who never lost his cool. Victor began looking for a chance to redeem himself, and it would come only a few days later. Blake sought to repeat his success. He found another good defensive position, this time near a village called Espinosa de los Monteros, and prepared to fight. Marshal Victor's 1st Corps arrived in the area on November 10th. As it turned out, Victor might have been a little too eager to redeem himself, and he was clearly still underestimating his enemies. He threw his men at the Spanish position without much thought or preparation. As we've seen many times in past episodes, these types of hasty, uncoordinated assaults rarely achieved their objectives, even when launched by superior forces. The French were thrown back again and again. By nightfall on the 10th, they had suffered hundreds of casualties and made basically no progress. 1st Corps might have been on the verge of their second humiliation in less than a week, but Victor and his officers used the night well, taking the time to actually plan and prepare a proper assault, as they probably should have the day before. The next morning, the French launched a massive, well-coordinated attack, focused on breaking the left flank of Blake's army. Everything went according to plan. The Spanish suffered heavy casualties, and Victor's men successfully broke through the line on Blake's left. The Patriots tried to counterattack, but were met with a brutal volley at close range. Unfortunately for the Spanish, many of the senior officers had chosen to lead from the front. Almost all were cut down. Most of the Spanish troops were raw recruits. After seeing so many of their comrades cut down, and now largely leaderless, they could not maintain the counterattack. French troops poured into the rear of Blake's army. He had no choice but to order an immediate retreat if he hoped to salvage the remains of his force. Despite their poor showing on the first day of combat, the French had managed to turn the Battle of Espinosa de los Monteros into a significant victory. Blake lost more than 5,000 men, over 20% of his force. The French lost around 1,000 men. Victor's corps had inflicted 5 casualties on the Spanish for every one they suffered themselves. This defeat was actually even worse for the Patriots than it looked on paper. Once he finally disengaged from the French, Blake found he had nowhere to run. He and his little army were hemmed in on almost every side. Their only choices were surrender or a difficult, dangerous trek through some of the roughest mountains in the entire country. This would not be easy. The Spanish baggage train, along with almost all of their supplies, had been captured by the French. But Blake chose to run. He would eventually succeed in saving the remnants of the army, but over the course of this brutal march, many Patriot soldiers died, and even more decided they couldn't bear the hardship and deserted. With Blake's defeat at Espinosa de los Monteros, the way was open to Burgos, one of the key cities in this region, and the first objective of Napoleon's plan. Bonaparte ordered Marshal Jean-Baptiste Bessières to take the city with his Second Corps, but inexplicably, for several days, Bessières barely moved. The Emperor had had enough. As we've discussed, throughout this period, he was becoming increasingly annoyed with his generals. In large part, he blamed poor leadership for this debacle in Spain. Bessières had the misfortune of being the straw that broke the camel's back, and so he would suffer the consequences. Napoleon ordered him removed from command of Second Corps. This was very rare right in the middle of a campaign. Bessières' dismissal must have really stung. He had been one of Napoleon's most loyal subordinates since all the way back in the First Italian Campaign. In fact, he was well known within the army for his almost fanatical loyalty to the emperor. Bonaparte did have a temper, and he was certainly angry, but this was actually not a bad move. Bessières also had a reputation as one of the least competent French marshals. If someone had to be made an example, Bessières was probably the best candidate. He was replaced by a much more capable leader, Marshal Jean de Dieu Soult, the former drill master who had been so instrumental in whipping the Grande Armée into shape during their time at the camp of Boulogne. Soult was already in Spain, ready to take command almost immediately. He pushed on Burgos with greater urgency than Bessières had shown. This would not be the only change in the French command structure. Bonaparte took the opportunity of Bessières' reassignment to reorganize all French forces in Spain, placing divisions in different corps and brigades in different divisions. This might sound a bit insane, undertaking this disruptive task right in the middle of a major offensive, in a fit of pique. But consensus among historians seems to be that this reorganization was completed successfully, without any major disruptions, and that it really did lead to better performance, so perhaps Napoleon knew what he was doing. It seems that once again the cutting-edge French staff system had achieved the impossible. Meanwhile, the chaos continued behind the Spanish lines. As Marshal Soult was bearing down on Burgos, the Patriot Army of Extremadura rushed to defend the city. Its commander had just been abruptly fired from his post. Unlike Marshal Bessières, he would not be reassigned behind the lines, but arrested on charges of treason, orchestrated by his political enemies. He was replaced by General Ramon Patiño, the Count of Belvedere. The Count was just 32 years old, roughly half the age of the typical Spanish general. He didn't owe his rapid rise to any particular talent or experience, but to the fact that he was a count and his father had been a senior general. The Spanish military really did itself a disservice with this practice of nepotistic promotion. If you'll think back to our episode on the Dos de Mayo uprising, you might recall one of the leaders of the insurgents at the Mataleon barracks, a very brave and capable officer named Luis Dawis y Torres. Dawis had been 41 years old and still only a captain. An army that lets a man like that languish at a junior rank for decades while allowing men like the Count of Belvedere to coast into senior positions without being tested is setting itself up for failure. Upon taking command, the Count immediately proved the naysayers right by adopting a truly terrible strategy. He would take the 10,000 men of the army of Extremadura out of the fortified city of Burgos to meet the French in open battle. Soult was bearing down on the city with over 20,000 men, and there were two more French corps in the area, totaling nearly 70,000 troops. Even if the two militaries were equally matched, this would have been a highly questionable move, but that was not the case. We've seen time and again over the past few episodes that the Patriots had difficulty standing toe-to-toe with the French in open battle. They had achieved success when Spanish commanders had found ways to even the odds, using fortified defensive positions, like at Zaragoza, ambushing isolated French units, as we just saw at Valmaseda, or using clever maneuvers and deception, like at Bailén. Belvedere chose a village called Gamonal to make his stand, so close to Burgos that today it's considered a neighborhood of the city. I wonder if any of his troops wondered what they were doing lining up out in the open with the comparative safety of the stone buildings and fortifications of Burgos so close by. Soult arrived on November 10th with over 20,000 men. The French would have a numerical advantage of more than 2-1, although Belvedere had put out the call for reinforcements, and a fresh infantry division was expected on the battlefield imminently. Soult had an unusually large component of cavalry at his disposal, so he decided to use it, starting the battle with a mass charge directed at the Spanish center and right. The Patriot volunteers lacked the training and discipline to form squares, and their firepower was not enough to prevent the charge from slamming home. In this open terrain, there was nowhere to hide. The French horsemen scattered the Patriot line like bowling pins. Panic spread quickly. The Spanish right and center were obliterated. French horsemen rode across the battlefield almost unchallenged, cutting down masses of frightened Patriot volunteers. The Spanish did have two trained regiments from the old Royal Army, and both of them were able to form squares and fight their way off the battlefield in good order, but the vast majority of the Army of Extremadura was completely helpless. They ran for Burgos, praying the French cavalry's sabers would find someone else. The young Count did try to rally his men, but no one was listening. The army had effectively ceased to exist. It was every man for himself. As the surviving Patriot troops fled the battlefield, some of them encountered that fresh infantry division that had been coming to reinforce them. Their panic was so great that it proved to be contagious. That fresh division routed too, without ever seeing a French soldier. The Battle of Gamonal was a catastrophe for the Patriots. In fact, the result was so lopsided, it almost feels wrong to call it a battle. In only a few minutes, Belvedere lost over 3,000 men. Most of the rest were in no condition for further campaigning, separated from their units, without supplies or equipment, and running for their lives in all directions. The Army of Extremadura had effectively ceased to exist. The victorious French entered Burgos and sacked the city. Once the madness finally died down, Bonaparte moved his headquarters to the city. Phase 1 of the second invasion of Spain was complete. Not everything had gone according to plan, but then again, whatever does. Despite Napoleon's frustration with his commanders, and some surprising setbacks at the hands of the Patriots, the French invasion was more or less on track. Two Spanish armies had been badly beaten. The army of Extremadura would need to be almost entirely rebuilt before it could take the field again. Blake's army of Galicia was starving and freezing on its desperate retreat through the mountains, and would not be playing any further role in the campaign for the foreseeable future. The French had reached their first objective, penetrating far beyond the old front line along the Ebro. Napoleon's offensive was only a few days old. Before the campaign had started, the emperor said he hoped to have it wrapped up in under 2 months. That might have sounded like arrogance, perhaps even hubris. But as of this point, I don't think it was out of the question. There were two more major Spanish armies in the north of the country that had not been destroyed or dispersed, the Army of the Center and the Army of Aragon. Now, they became the focus of French efforts in the north. The French would be looking for a measure of revenge. The Army of the Center was commanded by General Francisco Castaños, the victor of Bailén, and the Army of Aragon by General José de Palafox y Melzi, who had commanded the Patriot forces at Zaragoza. Part of the reason Napoleon had come to Spain was moral, not strategic. He wanted to show the world that the setbacks in the opening months of the conflict were nothing but a fluke. Defeating the man who had presided over the two most significant of those setbacks would go a long way to making that point. You might think this was the dream team for the Patriots. The two Spanish generals who had won the most glory in the opening months of the war had joined forces. But Palafox and Castaños started butting heads almost immediately. Under long-standing European military tradition, Castaños was the senior general and took precedence over Palafox. No one was disputing that. But the two men had very different ideas of how that would work out in practice. Castaños believed he was effectively empowered to take direct command over both armies, to issue orders to Palafox's subordinates as if they were his own. Palafox felt that because the two armies owed their allegiances to different juntas, he had a responsibility to maintain a separate command structure. Palafox was willing to defer to Castaños on matters of overall strategy, but believed his army should remain his army. If the Supreme Junta had managed to appoint an overall commander of all Patriot forces, this wouldn't have become a problem, but they had failed to do so. The generals appealed to Madrid to solve the issue, and the politicians agreed to send a two-man commission to the front to settle things. Castaños must have been very dismayed when he learned which two men the junta had chosen, Francisco de Palafox and Eugenio Palafox Portocarrero, the Count of Teba, General Palafox's brother and cousin. You can probably guess which general the two commissioners sided with. The armies would retain their separate command structures. This was almost certainly the wrong decision from a military perspective. A unified command structure is almost always preferable to separate parallel command structures. But the political balance in the country was very fragile. Military concerns sometimes had to be subordinated to political considerations. And of course, as they say, blood is thicker than water. At least the matter was now settled. However, the personality clash between the two generals was not. The relationship between Palafox and Castaños seems to have been completely poisoned by this incident. The French were coming. The two generals would have to find a way to work together very soon if they hoped to weather the storm. By this point in the campaign, Castaños' Army of the Center and Palafox's Army of Aragon were still roughly in their original positions along the Ebro River. Napoleon dispatched 3rd Corps under his old friend, Marshal Jean Lannes, and 6th Corps under Marshal Michel Ney to advance along the flanks of this position, hoping to trap the two Patriot armies. The Patriots recognized the danger and began preparations to retreat, but the question was, where? Some Spanish officers favored Zaragoza. As recent history had shown, if there was any location in Spain that could be described as a good place to hold off the French, it was Zaragoza. But Zaragoza was roughly 130 kilometers, or 80 miles, away. Retreating all the way to the city would mean surrendering a lot of ground to the French. These two armies were the only remaining Patriot forces that could theoretically stand between Napoleon and Madrid. If they went to Zaragoza, they would be leaving the way open to the capital. Castaños decided they could not give up that much ground. They would retreat. It was obvious to everyone they had no choice, but only about 45 kilometers, or 27 miles, to the city of Tudela. This was also a strong position. Castaños sketched out a defensive line, anchored on a series of hills just outside town, backed up by the Cayles River. As we've seen illustrated quite clearly in this episode, any Patriot force that chose to face the French in open battle was taking a big risk. These armies had a lot of limitations, and the French military was still the best in the world. But this was not shaping up to be a repeat of young Count Belvedere's disaster outside Burgos a few days earlier. Castaños and Palafox were capable leaders. Between the two armies, they had over 40,000 men, actually a numerical advantage over their French pursuers, who could only muster about 35,000. They would not be facing the French on an open plain, as Belvedere had tried to do, but on good high ground, in a place where the river could prevent them from being outflanked. With all that said, these were still ragtag rebel armies, short on artillery, with very few trained regulars in the ranks. We've spent a lot of time over the past few episodes discussing the weaknesses and limitations of the Patriot forces. I won't repeat them again here. These problems were compounded by supply issues. According to some sources, by this point, many troops in both of the Patriot armies were actually on the brink of starvation. Not only were they hungry, they were freezing. All of these units had been raised in the summer and issued summer uniforms. Now it was late November, the weather had turned, but none of the juntas had the means to issue warmer clothing. Many of the Patriot troops didn't even have coats to wear in the rain. Shoes were becoming a problem as well. Every mile the army marched, at least a few of the men would wear out their shoes. The juntas were unable to replace them as quickly as they wore out, and now, after several months of war, a serious deficit of footwear had built up. Many men in the Patriot ranks were wearing flimsy civilian sandals, or even just wrapped their bare feet in cloth. Both Spanish armies were suffering badly and not in top form. On the other hand, Castaños had looked pretty sharp as a strategist at Bailén, but many historians have criticized his performance in this phase of the war. While the terrain around Tudela was favorable for a defensive battle, he was taking a risk by choosing to fight the French with just two small armies in poor condition, isolated from the rest of the Patriot forces. In fact, the French were already moving to exploit his isolation. Bonaparte issued new orders to Lannes and Ney. Lannes would lead Third Corps in a direct attack on Tudela, while Marshal Ney took the smaller 6th Corps around the Patriot flank to envelop them from the rear. With a little luck, both Patriot armies would be forced to surrender. Castaños knew he had two French corps bearing down on him, and that a major battle was probably imminent. He should have been acting with urgency to prepare his forces and develop a plan of action. But his conduct during this period seems almost careless. Unlike many other Patriot commanders, Castaños had a large contingent of cavalry at his disposal, 3,000 horsemen, most of whom were trained regulars from the old Royal Army. As we've discussed in past episodes, Napoleonic-era cavalry was usually very active in the period before a major battle. riding close to enemy formations to learn about their strength and movements, trying to take prisoners for intelligence purposes, harassing enemy supply lines, and ambushing small enemy units, and of course trying to screen their own forces from enemy horsemen trying to do the same. Castaños did not order them to do so. They remained idle around Tudela, just like the infantry. Ney's movement on the Spanish flank went completely unnoticed, and the Patriots only had a vague idea of how Marshal Lon might approach their position. The rivalry between the two Spanish commanders was still simmering as well. On November 22nd, they agreed to meet in Tudela. They hoped to clear the air, find a way to work together, and develop a plan to face the French. Unfortunately for everyone, the meeting quickly descended into acrimony. Both men left angry, with no plan. The Spanish forces were not concentrated for a battle. They remained largely spread out. There were over 40,000 Patriot troops in the area, but fewer than 20,000 would actually be in the vicinity when Lon's corps arrived. When French cavalry began scouting the Spanish positions early on the morning of November 23rd, they reported that the Patriots were out of position and not ready to fight. Castaños had, at long last, ordered his units to concentrate, but the process was not going well. The inexperienced, often poorly led, Patriot troops had difficulty moving quickly under the best of conditions. This was compounded by hunger and cold, by the large number of men without proper shoes, and by the uncertain Spanish command structure. Remember, these were two separate armies. The Supreme Junta had affirmed that their command structures were to remain separate. This led to huge delays. Castaños sent orders to units from the Army of Aragon, who then sent back their objections to being issued orders by anyone other than Palafox. So Castaños had to then send messengers to Palafox's headquarters, who in turn had to resend the orders down their own chain of command. While the Patriots frittered away precious time on their general's petty rivalry, Lon was deploying his troops for an immediate attack. We've seen in this episode that French generals sometimes underestimated their Spanish enemies, leading them to throw lives away in premature, uncoordinated attacks, rather than marshaling their forces for a decisive blow. But surveying the situation around Tudela, Lon believed an immediate attack was the right move. The current deployment of the Spanish forces was simply inviting disaster. There were huge gaps between the Patriot units, no cohesive defensive line to speak of. The Spanish were moving to correct this, but so slowly that there was clearly time for an attack before their maneuvers were complete. This was not a situation in which it paid to be cautious. Lon decided to throw the dice and order his vanguard to attack as soon as they were ready, even though some of his units still had not arrived on the battlefield. It was almost certainly the right decision, but there was one big drawback. Marshal Ney and his Sixth Corps were not yet in position. Remember, this was supposed to be an envelopment battle, Lon striking the Spanish head-on, while Ney worked around the flank to cut off their escape and trap the two armies. However, by the time Ney received this order, the men of Sixth Corps were already exhausted after several days of hard marching. He had to rest them before ordering another forced march. Once they finally got on the road, they soon discovered the Spanish countryside was not conducive to rapid movement, to say the least. By November 23rd, Sixth Corps was still days away. Still, Lon could not pass up this perfect opportunity to attack two enemy armies totally out of position, and so the French began their attack. There were still huge gaps in the Spanish line, some as big as 10 kilometers, or 6.2 miles. It might be a stretch to call this a line at all. French cavalry engaged Spanish units to force them to stop their movements and keep the horsemen at bay, thus pinning down the Patriot forces and ensuring they remained isolated from one another. They never were able to form a cohesive line. Lan was able to do what every Napoleonic general dreamed of doing, defeating the enemy in detail, concentrating superior forces on each isolated Spanish unit. One by one, strategic hills and ridgelines on the battlefield fell to the French, and one by one, the Patriot units were engaged, outflanked, and sent packing. Shamefully, in some of these fights, there were other Patriot units nearby who could have moved to help, but did not, leaving their comrades to fend for themselves against a vastly superior enemy. This was not universally true. Some Spanish units actually fought quite well. Once again, the trained regulars of the old Royal Army tended to perform a lot better than the fresh volunteers. However, in this kind of battle, with one side concentrated, acting in unison, and the other side spread out, fighting in isolation, the toughness and courage of individual units couldn't do much to change the course of events. The killing blow came in the early afternoon. The most important high ground on the battlefield was a large hill called Santa Barbara, held by a Spanish infantry division made up of mostly fresh volunteers. The French skillfully used the terrain to maneuver around the flank of the Patriot position undetected, then launched a sudden attack from two directions. The Spanish division broke almost immediately. All 4,000 men took off running for the comparative safety of Tudela. We've seen in past episodes how panic could spread on a Napoleonic battlefield. This flight off the Santa Barbara Hill seems to have set off a chain reaction. Soon, many other Patriot units in the area were routing too. The Battle of Tudela was over. It had been a miserable performance by the Spanish, a complete failure of leadership by men who should have known better. Once again, the deficiencies of the Patriot forces had been brought into stark relief. So many of the problems with the Spanish government we've been discussing over the past few episodes had come together to help produce this disaster. The inability to properly feed and equip the armies, the failure to create a unified national command structure, and the prioritizing of political or even personal grudges over the wider war effort. The result was over 3,000 men killed or wounded, and about the same number captured. In a sense, the Spanish were actually lucky they had been so disorganized and spread out, because Lan had only been able to engage a fraction of the total number of Patriot troops in the area before both armies routed. The French only lost about 700 men killed, wounded, or captured. In the grand scheme of things, a very small price to pay for shattering two enemy armies. In the space of only a few weeks, four Spanish armies had been badly mauled in the north of Spain. The way was now clear for the final phase of Napoleon's plan, the push on Madrid. But we've already gone very long in this episode, so that story will have to wait for next time. As always, thanks for listening.